Increasingly, I am especially pleased because of having the pleasure to know him personally for some 10 years. But I would like to emphasize to you that apart from his creative work in theoretical physics over some decades with professorships at Penn State, visiting professorship at Imperial College here, and his membership now on the faculty of Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Canada. Apart from that, there's also wonderful books. The Life of the Cosmos and Three Roads to Quantum Gravity are already out and in print in your local bookshops. And please look out for the forthcoming The Trouble with Physics. And reading those books, as indeed reading Lee's technical work, you will see, if I may say without embarrassing him, you will see very high creativity, real craftsmanship in the writing and presentation, and a real liberal generosity about other people's work. So they're electrifyingly good reads, as indeed I'm sure will be Lee's lecture on Science and Democracy, the Essential Partnership. So thank you, Lee.
Well, thank you very much to Jeremy, to Stefan and the staff here for the invitation to lecture here. I want to say at the beginning, I'm very, very honored to have Jeremy here and to have some friends here, distinguished people from the philosophy of science world. But I'm embarrassed because this is a public talk. And this is a talk in which I confess at the very beginning, I am not making, as I usually do, an argument. I am trying to suggest themes of correspondence. And I hope that will be clear as I go on. I dislike lecterns, but I'll try to work with it. This is roughly the outline, and I think I'll go right to the theme. Why talk about a relationship, a partnership between science and democracy? And these thoughts that go into this talk really began with a concern for the future of liberal civil society and are meant as both a kind of defense of them, of our civilization and the values of our civilization, and an explanation, and if it's not too pretentious to say so, a kind of search for a renewal. In fact, okay, they don't work as well as they might. They certainly, it's a slogan to say that democracy is the worst form of government except the alternatives, and science perhaps also is the worst form of a search for knowledge except all the alternatives. And what we'd like to do is to improve them. And the thing that I'll come on to and was part of what, for me, the thoughts that went into this is that academics, and some of you here are academics, perhaps a few of you are not, academics are funny beasts because we have these very comfortable, for many of us, situations where we're invited to and supported to think about, you know, infinite space, time, infinite numbers, anything we'd like to, and yet we live inside of structures which are inherited from medieval monasteries which are designed to preserve old knowledge. And one often wonders, why do we assume that we do things the best way possible? And indeed, I sense a kind of crisis of liberal, you know, European, Western, certainly American democracy. Why do we assume we have the best possible form of government? And I am very aware that here at the LSE, there are people who work professionally on the issue of can we conceive of better forms of democratic government? And much of what I'm going to say, I'm sure, will be seen to such experts as they're here of, oh, he's talking about such and such a very smart personism point of view about something. And I make no apology for that. I'm a scientist trying to think my way out of some quandaries, as we'll talk about. Okay. Some of us grew up in a period in which there was a lot of talk about revolution, and we all grew up and matured and realized we want to evolutionize things, but how much, and indeed this is in the, here at the LSE, there's a great theme of evolution and Darwinism, and this talk is also part of that, but can we apply those notions to our own structures of knowledge and institutions where we work with that knowledge? Okay, and shouldn't we experiment? Yes? Is there? Would it be better? Is this better? Okay, I apologize. I will have to dispense with my... That's fine. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Okay. Now, I had the privilege 5 years ago of being part of starting a new research institute, Perimeter Institute, in which we were given ample resources and given the task of starting from scratch a scientific institute and saying, how can we, if one can start all over again, form a organization for research and science? Okay. And we've had a marvelous time. This is our second Christmas picture in our original building. And now we're in a beautiful, large building with 50 scientists going up to about 100. Here's some other view of it. And we've had to engage, to really take on the challenge given us by the founders of this institute, we've had to engage with the question of how does science work and what structures and forms of organization will best promote the progress of science. Okay. So we began to think and talk about these things. Now, there's a history, and the history actually has a lot to do with this institution, which was one reason I wanted to talk about this here, the LSE, of thought about how science works. There was the logical positivist movement, and this is just a quick tour, in which the emphasis was on verifying the truth of a statement by breaking observations up into alleged atoms of observation and comparing them with statements. And that was a failure. Then there was the point of view of Popper, which we all know, at least those of you who work in the field professionally of philosophy of science, was very influential and also insufficient. And I'll be coming on to points where Popper was insufficient. But the main slogan was that you can't verify the truth of a statement, but you can falsify the truth of a prediction of a theory by that prediction being contradicted by experiment. Then there was Kuhn, who argued, in spite of that, that science had a kind of structure. There were normal periods, there were revolutionary periods in which science functioned differently. And that sounded good. And when I was in college, every course had that book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, on its syllabus, and it sounded good until I started training as a scientist and asked myself, am I in a revolutionary period or a normal period? Because it seemed to matter a lot for how I managed my science and my career, and nobody could tell me. Then at some point, we encountered Paul Feyerabend, who's somebody who also, I believe, studied here, who argued strenuously that all of this is a cartoon. There is no method to science. Scientists are opportunists. We do whatever works to make progress, and however you define progress. And my encounter, both with his writings and in person with Feyerabend, I got the impression of somebody who cared very deeply about science and was convinced we had no idea why it worked, and left us, therefore, with the question, why does science work and how? Okay. So how does it really work if we buy Feynman's assertion that there is no scientific method? And I'm going to propose a point of view about this, a formulation. Okay. And it's that formulation which ties the working of science to the working of democracy. And the key idea is that both in scientific debate and progress, and in politics and society, we have people who begin with different points of view, who try to reason and argue and convince the other people in their community to come to some kind of decision or some kind of consensus, always in the presence of incomplete knowledge and information, always in the with the possibility of error. So how does this work? Okay. Well, my point of view is that the answer is complicated. First of all, science works because of some features of nature. That is, I don't think it would be useful to have a philosophy of science that applied to any possible creature in any possible universe. This is lots of technical problems. We happen to live in a world where there are regularities, at least of certain types. And how it is that science works also has a lot to do with our nature. Okay. We happen to have a peculiar nature in which, first of all, we're masters at quickly drawing conclusions from incomplete evidence. That's the kind of primates we are. That's the basis of our success. We see a situation, we assess it, and we go. Okay. And that's great, but there's a price to that. And the price is that we easily fool ourselves, and we easily fool other people. Of course, that's why lying is so sanctioned, because it's so easy, if we're honest. Okay? We are set up credible to believe. And when we are then faced with how do we get reliable knowledge, faced with this opportunity that we can think quickly and make conclusions quickly, but we can also easily make mistakes and screw up and fool ourselves and fool our friends. And the answer, which I think is at the heart of what science is and how science works, is that we've learned over long periods of time that there are crafts whose practice reduces and discovers error. And these are the practices you learn when you study biology or math, physics, and so forth. You learn a series of crafts, a set of crafts, which are designed to discover and reduce error. And becoming a scientist is the experience of assimilating those crafts. I think this is very ancient. The way that I think about it, way back in the caves in this fantasy original period, I mean, this is, of course, a cartoon, people were faced with this worlds that they were subject to, the world of nature, the world of the imagination, the world of society, the world of the spirit, if you will, and people slowly developed crafts and practices to gain mastery and some understanding over these worlds we found ourselves confronted with. And these are now what we call science, politics, art, and religion. Okay, these are ancient things. They go back to the very beginning. And the particular role of science in human culture and human society was to gain knowledge about the natural world that was reliable, and it was therefore based on crafts designed to discover and root out error. Okay. So I want to introduce a notion that I think is essential to science, which is that science is based on communities of individuals, okay, and a particular kind of community that I want to call an ethical community. This is a community of people which is joined voluntarily and where membership is governed by adherence to a certain ethic, different ethics for different communities, and practices, both ethics and practices. Okay. Here is what, and I'm going to illustrate this with some examples, here is what I think are the ethical principles which underlie communities of scientists. Okay. And they're two, and they're contrasting. The first is that if there is an issue or a question that people of good faith can decide on the basis of rational argument from public evidence, then they agree that it must be so decided. Okay? I don't particularly like the cosmological theory of evolution inflation. Okay? I find the theory of inflation strange, unconvincing, but I have to accept that the founders of the theory of inflation back around 1990 made certain predictions, and those predictions are borne out precisely in the WMAP data. And I have to acknowledge that whether I like it or not. Okay. If, on the other hand, this is the second principle, rational argument from the evidence does not suffice to settle a question, then it must be regarded as open, and people of good faith must agree to disagree. They must allow and even encourage diverse conclusions and controversy. Okay. So those are my two principles, and they go together, clearly. Okay. And I want to suggest, and again this is a talk about suggestions and not argument, that these same ethics underlie successful practices of democracy. Okay. And in, certainly in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, I think it's very clear we try to invent processes by which electorates or juries come to decisions about things, and we accept them as so decided, but we let there be a big open space always there for disagreement and controversy for things that cannot be or have not been decided. Okay. Now, these principles have consequences. And here are some of them. We agree to argue, first of all, that being in good faith and part of the community means that you are entitled to and required to argue based on your evaluation of the evidence. Everybody is encouraged to and free to develop their own conclusions from the evidence, okay, and put them forward. Okay. And this must be done publicly. The evidence that we argue from cannot be, as somebody once said to me, you know, theology is just like science, we just get our evidence from prayer rather than from experiment. No, that's not like science. In science, the evidence must be publicly accessible and scrutinizable. Okay. Now, the ability to make a convincing argument from the public evidence is what the crafts of science are all about, and there's no substitute for them. Scientists are highly trained people, like concert pianists or ballet dancers or something like that. They're people who undergo a period of intense training, the goal of which is to be able to construct and convey convincingly an argument within the subject using the tools of the subject. Okay. And the main thing that those tools do is give you the power and the ability to make convincing arguments within your community. The other thing, the second and almost as important thing that they do, is they instill in the scientist an awareness, an almost tragic awareness of their capacity for error and self-deception and self-delusion. That is, a highly trained scientist, an ethical scientist, knows that they can make mistakes. And it's that deep understanding that I could be wrong is part of the training. There's a kind of a double thing. There's a romantic image of the scientist as the rebel, like Galileo, who fights with the establishment and triumphs. And then there's the other image of science as a highly conservative, consensual community, which doesn't like disagreement. Okay. And I think that, and which tries to enforce consensus. And I think that a key to science is that both of these are essential and both of these are true. And a scientific community works when it has both the rebel and the conservative, and it structurally lets them work together. And even more than that, psychologically, each well-trained scientist is part rebel and part conservative in some mixture, depending on who they are. But when you become a scientist, you somehow take on this contradiction internally. Okay. Part of that is that as much, and many of us are very arrogant, and as much as one can be sure about what one is doing, one really knows that the people who will judge the correctness of your work are the students of your students. At some time after you retire or die, and anything that's important to you, so-and-so said so-and-so about my work, so I say this about them. All the normal human things that go on are gone, and people with better tools than you have will be able to cleanly make judgments that are at the edge of what you can do now. Okay. And what this means is that while there can be a lot of politics, a lot of messiness, a lot of violations of these ethics in the short run, in the long run, we trust it to the future to decide. Okay. A last thing, that entry to this community is based ideally, of course, there's lots, what I'm talking about is an ideal. There's lots and lots of pitfalls, corruptions, et cetera, of these things. But ideally, you enter a scientific community when you master one of the crafts to the point where you can make a convincing technical argument based on the evidence to your colleagues. And that's what a PhD thesis is. And secondly, you enter the community when you acknowledge adherence, and this is a part I think we don't stress enough, adherence to these ethics. Okay. Now, what this means is that science, when it's healthy, and this is something that Feyerabend stressed, that when science is healthy, there should be controversy about everything that's not part of the consensus. There is a process in science by which consensus forms and agreement is formed. On every question about which there is not consensus, science is healthiest when there is lively disagreement. Diversity of views, dissent, controversy, these are not accidental, these are essential for the progress of science. And this is important to remember because now science is highly professionalized. And in this high, which it didn't used to be, in this highly professionalized context, there are people, always people to whom it's to their benefit to force consensus early, to say my research program is the dominant paradigm of theoretical physics or computer science or some such, and to try prematurely to force consensus using whatever tools of academic politics and sociology and so forth they can. And these things our present institutions are peculiarly vulnerable to, and these are dangers. And I'm not going to speak more about them here. The book that Jeremy was kind enough to mention, the new one, is largely about this. There's a kind of vulnerability or brittleness in our present institutions which allows this to happen. And examples are artificial intelligence and string theory. And if you wonder about that, string theory is a long discussion, but can there really be progress in computer science when what's considered the best operating system that really the techies go for was written before I was born? I mean, is that a problem? Okay. Hence, and again, I'm just suggesting this, many of the same questions and issues, how to have a society where there is acknowledgement of the importance of the ethics which govern us, which allows both processes to come to agreement and disagreement when those processes are not sufficient. This is characteristic of both of science and democracy, and that's why I'm drawing the parallel here. Okay, now, this is not a complete characterization of science, so I have to add one more characterization, because there are communities that are ethical communities of the kind that I described, which are not scientific. For example, religious communities, or doctrinaire political parties like the Communist Party that my grandparents were members of, which could be characterized that way. So I have to introduce another element, and I call the other element imaginative community. And this is a little looser of a characterization, but it means a society that understands that the future will be full of surprises and believes in its ability to cope with the future, not because it thinks it understands what the future will be, but because it thinks it can train young people in an ethics and a set of techniques where they will be able to respond to and overcome whatever crises and surprises come in the future. Okay. So that's what I call an imaginative community. It has faith in whatever, it doesn't know the future, but it has faith in the processes by which it reaches agreement to deal with, that its future members will be able to deal with things that it knows will be surprises. And my claim is that, again, ideally, a healthy society, both a scientific community, an academy, an academic community, and a democracy, are healthiest when they are both imaginative and ethical communities. Okay. And I'm not going to argue that, I'm just suggesting that. And now I'm going to use some examples from science to learn something about the problems that we have in society. Okay. So one thing that all we scientists have dealt with for a long time, and more, is that this notion of pluralism, of immigration, of multiculturalism is something that we've been dealing with forever, because scientific communities for several generations have been formed by people from all the cultures and all the different religions, points of view, et cetera, of the planet. A formulation of this that I like very much is due to the writer Pico Iyer. I don't know if he's known here. He has a formulation in a book which he calls Global Souls. And Global Souls are people who live in a different country and language than they were born in and brought up with, and or are married to or living with a person from a different culture. Or another characterization he gives is if you spend more time in airports and airplanes altogether than you do with your parents or your brothers or your sisters, then you're a global soul. Okay. And he wrote, and our scientists are, so that's an example of all the places that our perimeter scientists come from. And he pointed out that if you look in the most influential professions in modern science, science, arts, banking, management, entertainment, etc., you see an exponentially growing takeover of all the local centers of influence by global souls. And certainly one sees that in London. London, is part of what inspired Pico Iyer. You see people from all over coming to centers of power and centers of influence. And of course, this is a slogan, it's part of globalization. A part of it that Pico Iyer emphasizes, though, is how do you deal with the paradoxes that result? For example, what do you do when you live in London? You're an American citizen, you're married to a citizen from, China. All your friends are similar global souls. None of you actually has the right to vote here in London. What's your relationship with the power structures here locally? Okay. And if more and more citizens of the world are going to be migrating in this way and influential, there's a disjunction with politics as it's been practiced on a very local level, where to be influential, if you exempt countries like Canada, where somebody can be an influential figure in Britain and the United States and then come back and run for a prime minister, which can only happen in a totally, only in a totally global soulized country like Canada can that happen. Otherwise, the centers of power in politics are people who grow up locally and have little contact with this. Okay, I'm going to skip a little bit and go to my next question. Okay. And again, I'm going fast through a kind of tour of a set of ideas, and stay with me, I am converging on something, but not very logically. Okay. So now, in science, we have a lot of experience making communities out of global souls, out of people from diverse backgrounds. So there's some practice. Okay. But interestingly enough, science on a deeper level offers some hints to how do we make democratic societies out of collections of disparate people. And what I want to embark on now is a very quick tour of intellectual history, science, and politics, emphasizing a theme which is not my theme, but is a theme of some real scholars. Of course, I'm just a scientist, I'm not a scholar, where people have seen parallels between, at any period, the understanding of cosmology and the understanding of society. And at first this seems like a joke, but bear with me, okay? I mean, this seems sort of too cute to be useful, okay? The first well-developed science of cosmology was Aristotelian Ptolemaic cosmology. That was a world which was utterly hierarchical. And here's, many of you have seen this picture of the Aristotelian universe. The Earth is in the center. There's the concentric spheres on which the planets live and rotate, the sun, the moon, the stars are on the outside, and then there's heaven and God and the angels outside. This is so intrinsic to our understanding of things that we instinctively think that more heavenly, more pure, more eternal is higher and more degenerate, more despicable is earthly and is lower. And that those metaphors come from this cosmology, which shows how powerful it is. And there was a perfect match, this is something, or a remarkable match, between the notion of hierarchy going from the earthly realm up through the realm of the unchanging crystal spheres up to the heavenly realm, where higher is more perfect, and the way that society was organized. These were times of completely hierarchical societies. That was then overthrown in a revolution that took us from Copernicus to Newton. And the picture of both nature, the picture of nature that evolves is very different. Okay. There's no longer any hierarchy. No place of space is different from any other. But space still has an absolute meaning. And things that exist, particles, get their properties, where they are, how they're moving, with respect to an absolute unchanging background of space, which for Newton had an entirely theological or a largely theological meaning. Space was the sensorium of God and existed forever, eternally, was unchanging, and things move around in it and are defined with respect to it. Every particle has its properties defined with respect to this absolute background of space, irrespective of what other particles exist. You could be in a world with 10 to the 80 particles if you're an atom, or in a world where you're the only atom and you have the same fundamental properties. Okay, so things are defined not with respect to each other, but with respect to this absolute notion of space. Okay. It's not apparently accidental that John Locke and Newton were good friends and read each other and talked to each other often, because this is also something like a picture of the liberal democratic world as invented by Locke and others, in which there are absolute notions of rights, and a citizen has rights which are defined with respect to those absolute notions, and you have the same sense of what rights you have whether you're in a village or in a modern society with billions of people. And indeed, this correspondence between Newtonian physics and the sort of classic liberal political theory and legal theory is something that's often been remarked on. So I'm just noting it here. Okay. Now, we are now in the course of a revolution which, like the previous revolution, is taking a long time. Our revolution started at the beginning of the 20th century with the births of quantum theory, special relativity, general relativity, and is still in progress. And if I was giving my standard science talk, that's what I would be talking about. But one can talk in a broad brush way about what's the picture of the world that's coming from the successes, for example, from our understanding of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And that's that the background that Newton defined everything with respect to has been banished. There's nothing more absolute and eternal and unchanging with respect to which properties of things are defined. All that there is a network of relationships amongst the things that exist and the events that happen. And the properties of anything in this world are just dependent on and consist entirely of those relationships and their changing. Okay. This means Newton's view very much was based on a sort of fantasy that there's a view, the complete view of the world is from outside, and that's the view of God. That's why space is the sensorium of God. It's how God knows where all his atoms are. Here, there's no view from outside. There are only partial views from observers who are part of the network of relations and are inside the system. Okay, so that's where general relativity is. That's what general relativity says space and time are like. It would take me a whole other talk to explain that, but that's the conclusion. And that's very different from from Newton's universe. Okay. And in fact, as we go more and more into inventing fundamental physics, it's more and more about the pictures that we draw and the structures that we use are more and more about networks and their evolution. Now, isn't that funny? The biologists draw pictures of networks and their evolution. The economists draw pictures of networks and their evolution. The computer scientists, the internet is a network which evolves, study networks and their evolution. So this metaphor of worlds which are networks which evolve in time, where the properties of things have to do with their situation in the network, is a widely used metaphor across many sciences now, interestingly enough, in even among, you know, people who've never spoken to each other. Okay. Even in logic, there's a notion of logic becoming more relational. Since the beginning of the 20th century, in what's called intuitionistic logic, there's been a movement in logic to not see logic as a description of absolute truth, where every statement is either true or false, but to see logics as systems which develop in time, in which what statements can be judged true or false depends on where you are in a network of logical relations. And this is elaborated in a branch or an approach to mathematics called topos theory. Even in logic, one sees this change from the idea that there's an idealized, eternal static sphere of knowledge in any realm about things that just either are true or aren't true with respect to some absolute framework, to the notion that knowledge is about information that some player inside a system has, which may grow in time and may differ from the knowledge that other players in different situations may have. Now, what about social theory? Okay, and I don't want to preach about social theory here at the LSE, but I'm going to, again, point to some connections. I was very surprised to discover that similar discussions are going on among people in legal theory and political theory. That is a transition from an understanding of law based on a notion that there's an absolute systems of rights and justice and judges make judgments with respect to it, to a notion of an evolving set of laws. Here is an influential social legal theorist, Roberto Unger, who I believe lectured here in January, and who Simon and myself and some other people in physics and philosophy of physics have had an interesting dialogue with recently. And I hate it when people read, you can read for yourself most of this, but let me just emphasize two key sentences. You cannot show that the properties of the present universe are the only properties a universe may have had. To state the laws of nature is not to describe or explain all possible histories of all possible universes. Only a relative distinction exists between law-like explanation and a narration of one-time historical sequence. Okay, and here's a key sentence. If you are asked what you mean by the necessity of the laws of nature, you can legitimately respond only by laying out the substance of your cosmological and other scientific ideas. People who appeal to fixed conceptions of necessity, contingency, and possibility are simply confused. Okay. Now, this is a theme, as I've argued, in physics, in thinking about quantum theory, which I have not tried to argue, to some extent in the foundations of mathematics, okay, in evolutionary theory. But this is a legal theorist writing about law. Okay. Here's also the only thing that Jacques Derrida ever said that I understood. But it is about the same thing. This, I believe, and this, maybe I'm going too fast, so I should give you a little bit of language. This change from a Newtonian perspective to an Einsteinian perspective is called a change from an absolute notion of space and time and properties to a relational notion. Okay, and this is, I believe, closely related. The revolution, which I think is the transformation from an absolute to a relational framework of natural science, is also related to the Darwinian revolution. And part of it is that in a relational world, okay, what distinguishes two things, two particles, two events, is that their relations to the rest of it are different. In a relational world, you have to have variety, complexity. If everything is the same, then there's nothing. Because the only way you distinguish things is from the relations they have to the rest. And so, and I'm just going to go over this, I'm just saying this, this is another thing I'm throwing out as part of the picture I'm making, that one needs, for a relational universe to be big like ours, it has to be complex, and therefore there must be mechanisms which cause complexity, which self-organize, in the jargon. And so all the stuff about self-organization is part of this picture as well. This goes all the way down to the laws of nature itself, and indeed this is another philosopher who's been very who's been very influential, at least in the American scene, Charles Sanders Peirce. From 1891 he understood, I won't read this to you, but what he understands is what is the present crisis in physics, in which we know to a very good precision what are the laws of nature. We don't know everything, there are still mysteries, but we know an enormous amount. In many domains, we have theories that correctly predict every experiment that's ever been done. And the question that begins to dominate fundamental theoretical physics is why these laws and not other laws? Why is the mass of the electron what it is and not twice the value or three halves times the value? Why is there a neutrino, etc.? Why is there electromagnetism? And Peirce understood more than 100 years in anticipation that by the time science got to the point of asking why these laws and not other laws, that the only possible rational explanation would be through evolution, that is to see laws of nature as results of evolution. So this is also part of the picture. Okay. Hence, Darwinism, okay, and relativity and quantum theory are deeply intertwined, and they give us together a kind of first sketch of a worldview in which the world is an ever-evolving network of relations in which everything big and small is subject to being rewritten and being invented. And the challenge which Roberto Unger and other people in social theory are picking up is, can we conceptualize society this way, and even to rise to the challenge of having truly diverse, pluralistic, healthy democratic societies, must we conceptualize democracy this way? Okay. There's a, I hope this is fun, because I've never given a talk quite like this in which I jump around between different things. So I hope, I mean, if it's painful, scream or something. Because I'm not yet done going where I'm going. I have to mention a trap and then get us out of the trap. Okay. And the trap is relativism, or in its modern form, postmodernism. The trap is, oh my God, there's no absolute framework of rights and justice. So then everything is fine. Oh my God, there's no absolute test of when a scientific idea is correct or not. So therefore, anything goes, intelligent design, astrology, witchcraft. The trap is, there's no, the old canons about what makes a painting beautiful or a piece of music beautiful are wrong, they're dead, they've been superseded. So therefore, art is not about beauty or inspiration. And we have the young British artists, if I may. And we go to art museums not to be inspired and uplifted, but to be shocked and disgusted. Because everything is just relative. Okay. Now, relationalism is not that. Relationalism does not say that all points of view and all experiences are equally valid. It says that to be taken seriously, if you have a point of view, you're welcome to your point of view if you can make a case which is well argued based on a finely honed craft. not every art is equivalent. If you want to contribute to the progress of art, you have to bring to it craft and skills, which, as well as an appreciation for the situation and history and the ethic of what you're doing. You must have a commitment that you may be forced to change your mind because other people's evidence and arguments from the evidence may outlast yours and triumph over yours, logically. Okay. And so in relationalism, there is a notion of progress in science as well as, I hope, I dream of, in society and in art. It's not relativism. Okay. Now, in my own experience, I'm an academic. I work in universities, at least until some time ago. I worked in universities, and I'm a theorist. So it was disturbing 15 years or so to find that I had colleagues who were calling themselves theorists that I didn't understand. And I would go to their talks. They were doing literary theory or social theory or whatever theory, and I thought, I'm a theorist. And I would go and I would get nothing. Okay, and I didn't understand I sensed that there was something I didn't like in all of that, and I think it was the trap of this relativism that very smart people, being smart doesn't prevent you from falling into intellectual traps, especially if you're very well trained, because then, you know, wherever you are, you're taught to dig. So if somebody throws you in a hole, you dig, and then you're just in deeper. So I found, and I went looking for people to explain to me what is all this postmodern stuff about. And I found that the only people who could explain it to me in a language that I could understand were visual artists. And I think there were two reasons. One of them is that they had to be very articulate because their livings depended on it. That is, their markets and their dealers' ability to sell and their ability to get dealers so interested in their work depended on having a response to relativism and postmodernism. And secondly, because the two-culture split is not where it's often said to be. There is a two-culture split, but I think where the two-culture split is between humanists, on the one hand, who work with texts and whose skills and crafts are about taking texts and interpreting them, producing other texts, and those of us who work with our hands, whether we do experiments or do calculations or whether we make sculpture or compose music or design buildings or engineer buildings, we're in touch with every moment with the fabability of what we're doing because we're in confrontation with a nature that often doesn't share our romantic delusions. And so the visual artists are on the same side of the two-culture divide as the scientists, I think. And so I was able to learn from them how to think about this. And so I'm going to tell you something and show you something about what I learned from them and then close. And I hope this is the riskiest part of the talk because I'm going to make good use of the screen here. We're going to, you know, since I'm not making an argument, I'm trying to evoke something I'm going to evoke. But before that, a quote. This is somebody who, St. Clair Simin is a sculptor, originally Brazilian, who lived for many years in New York and now lives in Paris. And this was, for me, a very important moment in my understanding when, at a party, he said this: if the purpose of modernism in art was to burn the old classic house down, all that postmodernism has been doing since is playing with the charred little pieces that were left over, which is a pretty puerile thing to be doing considering that winter is coming. And so St. Clair Simin was one of the artists who, out of self-interest, had to think himself out of the trap of relativism, and this was how he did it, the same through the craft and the art. So this is homage to Darwin, and I think the LSE is the right place to start with, a homage to Darwin. But of course, there's the other side, homage to Sartre. And I'll just show some of the work. And what I see, I know you didn't expect to come to a talk by a scientist about political theory and see art, but tough. I hope it, I hope it works. Then I'll close up with some words. One in many, it says chair on that little piece of paper. Because what's happening here is that people, this is a painter, Donna Moylan, are responding to the fact that you can no longer do academic painting, you can no longer even do classic modernism, okay? But at the same time, you can do things which aim to inspire, which aim to evoke, and not just disturb. This is Beth Turk, Elizabeth Turk. These are marble pieces. These are all marble pieces. And finally, Ray Smith, who epitomizes the global soul. Despite the name, he's a Jewish Mexican. But those who know the history of 20th century art in Mexico will see right away that he's a Mexican, and not just from the horses. So what am I trying to say? So stripping away all the hesitations and clauses that we academics put in our writing to make sure that we can't be attacked for saying something silly, here is the silly stuff that I'm trying to evoke. Okay. First, that beauty and truth are real, and they're no less real for not being anchorable in some fantasy of some eternal, absolute, transcendent background, which is the way that in previous centuries people justified beauty and truth and belief in them to themselves. That is, there was a God or there was a Platonic realm where everything that was true absolutely, and that justified our belief, or that justified our inspiration and our sense of beauty. No, there is none, but nonetheless, beauty and truth are real. Okay. Given our situation as limited observers in the natural world, the search for truth and beauty is a choice, and it's a choice that there's no other construction for it but ethical. That is, you don't want to make science that's true, that's fine, that's your truth. If you think that what science, if you have other aims, that's fine. If you're not, you want to do something else, I don't like it, but we live in a democratic society, that's fine. But if you want to search for truth that's an ethical truth and that binds you into the consequences that I've tried to indicate, you join a community, you get from that community a training in a craft which will make you much more powerful than you would have been otherwise, and you give up the childish belief that you're going to be right and you're going to see absolute truth. Okay, so you make an ethical choice to join a process in a community which has more power to go towards truth than you do as a whole. And I think that I'm not an artist, but I think that art is something like that too. I think artists are well aware that they're part of a tradition in which there's a notion of furtherance and progress. At least many artists, not all, feel that way. In a pluralistic world of the kind that I've pointed to, where artists and scientists identify themselves as members of these communities that bind them logically, that have a notion of the future, of the imagination, of the openness of the future, there can be a notion of progress. And it's a progress that for any people alive at any particular moment is unfillable. Okay. It's, you know, Feynman, you know, used to say that the worst thing was the idea that he wouldn't live long enough to see the answers to the questions that he most cared about. And that's tough. That's the way it is. But you contribute to it because of your belief in the powers of the community and the ethics of the community to continue to form individuals who contribute. Okay. Truth and beauty, while they exist, are fragile. They're ever open to challenge in the small scale and in the large scale, and ever open to surprise and novelty. And it's our job to discover, nourish, and protect beauty and truth. We can believe, one can believe that one will know more in the future without believing that at some time everybody will know everything, or even anybody will know everything, or that there's some abstract Platonic sense in which the truth already exists outside of time. Okay. And I also want to claim that this ethic that I'm pointing to here is also something that has the spirit of democratic society. We are embedded within a complicated network of relationships, living as we do in the real world, in our cities, in our states. Nobody is in control. There are people who would like you to think that they're in control, but they're not. But still, there's a belief that if we buy into, that is agreed to be part of a community with an ethic of the kind I've described, that people in the future will live better. Even if the notion of central planning and the notion that it can be all planned out and scoped out is thankfully dead. Okay. And I'd like to close with words of a philosopher who many of you will know, Leibniz, who was, for some people, the sort of visionary of this relational point of view. And I'll just read it. It's a little poem in which he says, "This interconnection or accommodation of all created things to each other brings it about that each simple substance has relations that express all the others, and consequently that each simple substance is a perpetual living mirror of the universe. Just as the same city, London, Paris, Toronto, viewed from different directions appears entirely different and as it were multiplied perspectivally, in just the same way it happens that because of the infinite multitude of simple substances, there are, as it were, just as many different universes which are nevertheless only perspectives on a single one. And this is the way of obtaining as much variety as possible, but with the greatest order possible, that is, it is the way of obtaining as much perfection as possible." Okay. And I'll stop there. Thank you. At least nobody's rushing for the exits yet.
Hello. I was with you until this page, actually, the beauty and truth page.
Okay.
The way you're talking about those, it seems as though you're saying that they exist independently of us and what we think about things, as though they're separate kind of entities floating around in the universe, qualities of things that we have to discover and protect and so on, rather than being a product of us, actually, which is what I would prefer to think. So is that what you mean? I mean, this whole page sort of seems to suggest that their truth and beauty exist, but they're fragile. I mean,
if you're with me with the rest of it, and okay, then I think this is precisely the point on which one agrees to disagree. Let me put the point in the most difficult issue, but which I think is the core, is where the core issue is, which is with mathematical truth, if you don't mind. Okay. So what is the nature of mathematical truth? Okay. Now there is a view that I think many people, certainly most working physicists have, and many mathematicians I know, which is the old Platonic view, there is a realm of eternal truth in which the facts about, you know, triangles or Platonic solids are true, always were, always will be, and we remember them or we discover them. And now you're accusing me of just, after all that, falling back to that Platonic notion. And it's a quite acute criticism. I don't believe that. Okay. But at the same time, I don't believe that mathematical truth is just convention or agreement among mathematicians. A thing that I think is the essential point is that there's an infinite range of objects of mathematical study. That is, one can define a mathematical system by some axioms, by some rules, by a game. And then, just like in chess, there's a very, very large number of games that can be played out. Do all the games of chess exist because somebody once stated the rules? I don't think there's a Platonic realm where all the games of chess exist, but nonetheless, there are things that are true or false. Checkmate is checkmate, etc. And I don't play chess, so I don't know, but there are many, many things about a position, a game of chess, which nonetheless are true, even if it's being played for the first time in the history of the world. Okay. So I have to be committed to a notion of truth, which is real, but which grows in time, and which, although unalterable once discovered, okay, is created by our discovery. Okay. And I think that this is the key question, is how to believe in that, how to believe that somebody could, sometime in the future, invent a game. Nothing about that game exists now. I don't want to believe in an infinite realm of possible games or anything like that. I don't think there's any reason or work that that notion does for us. But once that game is created, okay, there will be things that are true and false about it, which will be discovered as people play it. Okay. And once discovered, there will be things to preserve and things that people of good faith will be forced to agree about: who won a game, who lost a game, what was a good position, what was not a good position. And I think that part of the challenge, I mean, we're very much at the beginning of this, part of the challenge is to develop such a notion of truth, which is both unalterable once arrived at, but created by our discovery of it. And I don't know, I think if that's the, or one of the central challenges. I don't unfortunately have such a notion.
Gentleman at the back.
I'm just a little bit worried by the notion of democracy. And I think perhaps we should call these scientific communities mini democracies. And they may not all be operating same way as you have suggested this evening, but they also have a kind of responsibility to the rest of society, and that puts powerful scientists in quite an authoritative position.
Excuse me, could you turn the microphone on? It seems not to be on. I heard you so far, but I want to make sure.
I can't speak very well.
Yeah.
I'm concerned
about heard you
democracy.
So far.
Yeah, but also scientists could easily become in a position of authority. I think George Orwell wrote an essay about this. What we can believe in the world depends very much on what the scientists tell us what to believe. And that seems to me rather undemocratic. I'm not putting forward an argument, but I'd like to know what you think about that.
I agree with you, and I think that the only authority that I'm looking for a word, I don't know if I want to say science or a scientist, has, okay, is in an argument that was made. And I do agree with you that there are many issues in society where decisions have to be made about matters scientific, whether it's global warming or GM foods or a host of other things in biology, medicine especially. When scientists assert special authority, they sabotage a process of democracy, because these are properly decisions that the society must make through whatever political structures it has, through its elected leaders and so forth. And part of my, and maybe I did it badly, but I was very aware that I wasn't touching on this. I thought I'd already put too much into the talk. But what I hope to do by, through such a picture of science, is open it up so that one understands two things, because there are two sides of this. One of them is that science is nothing but rational argument from publicly available evidence, and everybody is able to reason rationally, and the evidence is public. So therefore, members of the public, members of governments, can scrutinize the arguments. When there are competing arguments, they can scrutinize them and can and must come to their own decisions about them. On the other side, at the same time, the preparation of the evidence for the arguments is something that requires training, and this is also to be acknowledged. So, and the two things have to exist. Now, what I think is the proper role of a scientist in saying this, or of the public education of science, especially with these crucial issues, is to educate the public and educate the decision makers. So here's the issue, here's the evidence. I think in, let me say, a case like global warming, where there is essentially consensus among experts. That's my understanding. I'm not an expert. Okay. It's not sufficient just to say, and in fact in my country, you know, my original country, the United States, doesn't work to just say to the government there is a consensus amongst experts. Okay. To the extent that the governments are interested, I think one has to explain, okay, this is the evidence and this is the process by which the consensus was reached. These are the strong points, these are the weak points, these are the dissenting views. I don't think we should ever be ashamed to try to hide the existence of dissenting views. This is why the dissenting views are no longer taken seriously. Another case might be the link between HIV and AIDS, which is a case which was at one time controversial among experts. There are still some experts who hold out, although I don't understand why. So I hope I'm addressing your question. And there's also, finally, because of that, it's a response. There's a responsibility also for the citizens. That is, if you want to participate in a democracy where decisions are made about scientific issues, as we all must, one must gain a proper amount of education, not just to be able to recite the names of the elements or different molecules or something, but to really understand what the process is and how it works. Okay, sorry for going on with that.
Thank you. Okay, we have a bit of a cue. Dr. Frick, then Professor Frick.
Yeah, you started off by drawing our attention to certain similarities and analogies between the realm of science and of politics. And then in the second part of the lecture, you mainly focused on the science side and explained what the trap of relativism is, how we get into it, and also how we get out of it. And your suggestion is that we have all this notion of craft and of education and of skilled labor, as it were. And so people who do have this skill, they can advance the field and make progress nevertheless. Well, it may be a controversial question whether that works, but let's assume it is. I'm not entirely clear how to bring this idea back to the world of politics. First, I can make sense of the notion of progress in science. I'm not entirely clear of what progress in democracy would mean. And second, what are the skills particularly that someone participating in democracy has to further the cause of progress of democracy, and how do you issue relativism there? I just wonder whether you could say a bit more about that side of the problem. Thank you.
I'm not going to say much to satisfy you, and the reason why the talk went the way it was is because I'm not a political theorist, and I wanted to point to where I think there are interesting parallels, but I wasn't going to go places where I didn't know enough to go. But just two things. I think the both obvious, so I apologize for wasting your time with them. One of them, I think there was a time when the assumption was, you know, when Locke and the makers of the French Revolution, the American Revolution, formulated, and the philosophers that influenced them formulated notions of democracy, there was a sense of a community which was already monocultural, largely monocultural. And I'm not a historian, but that's the image that I have. And a challenge facing all the modern democracies, the European democracies, the United States, Canada, Japan, to a lesser extent to their peril, is to reinvent a notion of a healthy parliamentary democracy in which all the citizenry, no matter where they come from, how recent, how long they've been there, feels well represented and is in fact well represented. And it is a challenge. So I think that there are theoretical issues there, which I know people who are experts discuss and debate, so I'm not going to go there. And I think that is part of the same challenge that I talked about. That is, if we can't make reference to common religious, common historical background values in justifying your political structures, okay, how do you justify them? And the answer, as far as the second question, I think is easier, skills of democracy. I think there are skills in politics. I think politics is a skill. We may or may not agree with, like, whatever people in political life or people in political life, academic political life, but those who are successful, by my observation, are highly skilled at certain skills of human interaction. Anybody who can run a caucus or run a meeting and get a result out, that's a skill, and it's a skill that, in my understanding, is taught by apprenticeship. Maybe that's not adequate, but it's a start.
Okay, thank you. For something.
I think your idea of an ethical community is a wonderful one, and there may even be some places where there are such ethical communities. But I wouldn't have thought science was a good candidate for that. If you actually look at the history of science, although people may have subscribed to some of the ideals you mentioned there, the reality is that they haven't acted by them at all. All the great scientists you've mentioned, all except perhaps for Charles Darwin, were all prima donnas who refused to accept other people's opinions, wouldn't change their minds when the evidence was put in front of them, and so on. In fact, it's been well said that no one ever changes their mind, they just die. And then students come along later on who actually have a different opinion from the people who are teaching them. And I think even the case of art, even less. Artists notoriously don't change their minds in response to a new wave or a new... they may join it, but they, on the whole, they go on doing their thing and they'll fight for the importance of what they were always involved in. And I think that... I mean, what worries me is that although the ethical community you described might actually do a better job of it, it wouldn't be one in which people want to work. That actually people aren't like that. They're motivated by competition, by prizes, by winning arguments, and so on. It's deeply, and at some level, I mean, another Darwinian analogy, there really is a process of a struggle going on there, and it's highly creative and adaptive. At least the outcome of it is. But I saw you with in your Christmas photograph, sitting amongst obviously a wonderful community there. And this is a very serious question. Are you trying to really teach people to do science differently, and is it succeeding? What has been the outcome of this idea you have of the way science ought to be done, the kind of people we should be.
Thank you. Obviously, the picture that I painted is deliberately an idealization, is a set of ethics to uphold. Obviously, everything you say is true. There is a lot else that goes on, a lot of egotism, a lot of not listening, a lot of transgressions of the ethics. Nonetheless, so I'm going to take the first point first. Nonetheless, I think that why in the end science works is that from a combination of younger people coming on later, people changing their minds, the community does form consensus that views previously held and often rather recently held are incorrect and other views are more correct. And we have to remember, I mean, it's the thing about, you know, people are there till they die and then the young people believe differently is fine, but in most academic organizations, the younger people who think differently were hired by the older people. Okay. And a lot of the ethics, for better or worse, is expressed in the process by which we choose who gets to sit in our places. And so I do believe that, however imperfectly it's realized, the notion of an ethical community explains something. Okay. Part of my search for this, I have to say, I mean, part of this is comes from the situation of being a part of a smaller research program confronted by a larger research program, a much larger research program, claiming dominance and relevance in spite of being able to make a case for itself by arguing from any evidence, either experimental or theoretical, that is a convincing, not a case that it's interesting, but a case that it's right. And so I, for me, part of this is a foundation for, and I know that there's a conference here going on at the LSE about dissent in science, and I think one has to have a foundation to dissent on. After all, if it's all Darwinian, in your use of Darwinian, which I'm, or all quote sociology, or all quote politics, then whatever, you know, the faculties at the richest university say is scientific truth, and then I think we're in deep trouble. I think it has to be possible to have a framework for what science is that lets there be dissent and disagreement when there's not a consensus which is rigorously justified by the evidence. So that's part of what I'm looking for. As to perimeter, its perimeter began and very idealistically, it still is rather idealistic. It's like any story, it's complicated. You know, the I have no, you know, I have the, because of a belief in democracy amongst the founders, all of us, the those of us who are a little older have no particular power over those of them who are younger. And it's interesting, it's an interesting experiment. I think it's too soon to tell the success of the experiment, but I would think some visitors find it a quite lively and stimulating place, and I think that some of that is just the energy of founding something new, and some of that, I hope, is the idealism that we were founded with.
Okay, thank you. We have time for three more questions, and so it's first the lady at the back.
I wanted to ask, consider a parallel imaginative community to be the discussion, like Judaism, the Jewish discourse on Halakha? I mean, would that basically how Jewish scholars have this discourse, this running discourse on Jewish laws. Would that be, even though it's religious, would that be a parallel?
Yes, and my understanding, which is not very deep, is that within Judaism, as well as within the other major religions, there are some trends in theology which not only are characterizable in similar terms, although the goals are different, the ethics are different, the tools are certainly different. There is, and I'm looking for the name, somebody will help me, but there is certainly a brand of theology which is self-consciously relational, although that's not the word they use, process theology, that goes back to Whitehead. I think this is more in, at least the strands that I know come from Christian more than Jewish theology, but there may be elements of Jewish theology that trace themselves back to Whitehead as well, and I think so, and I think that I know there's a lot of discussion about science and religion, and in the United States we have an issue of fundamentalism, which is different, which is people who are outside of a consensus where rationality governs, and there are problems. That's a problem, but outside of that, I'm not a theologian. But I'm not afraid of dialogue and discourse between scientists, philosophers, and theologians in the modern liberal tradition, as long as due regard is taken for what's quite distinct about each of them.
Thank you. Dr. Saunders, second row.
Hi. Lee, lots of ways in which I warm to your message, but some ways in which not. And I want to comment on one point, which I think some of the other people in the audience were also taken by, perhaps not in the best way. Could you perhaps go to the slide in question? It was where you put up two principles, as it were, both governing the scientific community and possibly broader communities, one being where consensus is reached, it should be honored. Where consensus has not been reached.
It's harder than I thought. Hold on.
Perhaps number 18?
Boy, you're good. Okay.
Okay, can you expand it? Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Okay, I just wonder about this. I mean, it did seem to strike a discordant note with much else that you said and actually much of what I know of you. And it's also quite an interesting note, but I wonder if it's the right one. There's something to, as it were, a hard edge to the form of humanism that you are advocating, but I don't know if this is the right one. And I just wonder, one sort of an uncharitable way of looking at it is that both of these principles are rather vacuous insofar as how do we know when an issue has been decided or not? You know, you say if it can be decided, but the debate, as it were, goes on. So where does one draw the line and say, oh no, you know, we haven't succeeded, therefore, you know, it falls into category two, or you know, and so forth. And I think that this is the sort of needle-picking criticism that a philosopher often makes, which actually isn't easily answered. You know, so that it gets worse if you try to patch this up and look after the time element. You'll find it sort of gets worse and worse and worse. I just wonder if you'd be sympathetic to a rather different point of view, or a different way of perhaps putting it, which is this, that where consensus has been reached through rational deliberation on the basis of public evidence, then it's not so much that it should be it's rather that it be respected, that it be not ignored, that it be what sets, as it were, the stage. And I think this is a point that Feyerabend never properly took on board, that it's all very well, no method and so forth, but one ends up with a complete fragmentation of the community. Nobody has time to listen to anybody else anymore. And it seems a very important aspect of scientific discipline and so forth, that there is that, as it were, attentiveness to what has been achieved. And I'm not sure how the historical record would fare with this. There was a comment earlier that the historical record doesn't at all fit with this, but I think that probably every great scientist did actually take on board some substantial achievement that was made perhaps not every, but some dominance and substantial achievement, and that was absolutely critical. No serious progress could be made without that. But then, of course, the corresponding number two is that even where there has been consensus, and even though one is paying respect to that consensus, then let it also be open to challenge. So, and I just wonder whether this would better combine, perhaps, what you're trying to say here.
Thank you. Simon, as always, I think I stand corrected. I mean, point well taken. I don't read, and maybe this is the difference between the precision of articulation by a philosopher and some, you know, scientist, but I don't take what you said as very different from this, although I understand when you get to points of precision, it can be. Certainly, there are two ways in which consensus is revisited. There can be, on the one hand, new evidence or new arguments, okay? Or it can simply be that people were mistaken and somebody realizes that sometime in the future. And certainly, both of those things do happen. When I call something ethical, what I'm trying to articulate here is not so much a description of what happens historically or what happens sociologically, but principles by which we tell to each other how we should behave, why our way of being, of living, of arguing is different, why we think it's successful. That's really what I'm holding for. So that's why there's sort of woulds and shoulds behind this rather than must be, you know, should be respected in the past. But point well taken, and thank you.
Okay, we're entering injury time, so we have to be quick now. So you've been very patient. I'm afraid this has to be the last question.
You referred earlier on to some people trying to force consensus making claims to being the dominant paradigm, and that they actually end up by slowing progress. You then gave string theory as an example. I'm just wondering whether that's sort of in the overall or context of speeding up the search for the theory of everything. And it remains obviously just a theory, so you can't get involved in proving it's true or false at this stage. Perhaps you could just elaborate on why you gave that example, in what context, and in what respect.
Thank you. I gave that because I was hoping somebody would bring it up. but since it's the last question, I won't go on it much. It is. I believe that at this time, many people, including and string theory is something that I've devoted myself a number of years to working on, and people, friends of mine, have devoted much more time to it. And I think there's a sense that it's in crisis, that if there is some aspect or some sense in which it's right, it's not the one that was originally conceived or hoped for, that something big is missing, and therefore that raises some questions. And one of the questions, I want to be mindful of Jeremy's thing, so I'll just leave with some questions. So one of the questions is, if there is indeed something which is missing, what is the nature of the mistake? If hundreds of the smartest, that's their characterization, okay, but I largely agree with it, okay? I mean, I'm not sure, okay? And best trained and best situated scientists in a given field, in their best judgment, okay, find that they were mistaken. And whether string theory is ultimately right or wrong, it's clear that the original hopes for it were mistaken. Okay, that's an interesting error. It's not a simple mistake. It's not like, oh my God, 2 + 2 is really equals to 4. We did the arithmetic wrong. There's some profound error that was made. And if there was a profound error of judgment of construal of the situation, of construal of the evidence, why there must have been people who saw it. Okay. And my belief, and I don't have time to develop it here, but it's developed elsewhere at great length, is that there are people who did see plausibly a number of different things that might be the key, and that because the community was led not completely in accordance with the ideals that I've suggested here, the mistake was not recognized or corrected or even discussed until it became a crisis, which is what it is at the present moment.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's a slight vein of foreboding in those final remarks of Lee's about the nature of science, or at least one present predicament in science. But I'd like to end on a more upbeat note, which is characteristic of the event as a whole, and that is, if I may, go back to what I said at the beginning. I mean, we've had an evening of enormous creativity and ideas, but also an open and communitarian perspective on inquiry. And in that spirit, Lee, I'd like to ask everybody to join me again in thanking you for a splendid occasion.